Good evening.
Radio.
This is Family Matters. Welcome. Thank you for tuning in tonight. I'm Jill Ogeezy, and of course, with me, as always, is the lovely Judge Michelle Laurent. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jill.
How are you?
Well, in the sense of my professional life, I'm actually a little, I've been kind of fired up all week.
Oh, okay.
And why? I guess, well, obviously without mentioning any names, but somebody, what fired me up was, the case came on Tuesdays, I do the uncontested, the settled cases.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to me, and the dad was just supposed to get 5 hours a week visitation. So even though it's uncontested and they agreed to it, I said, well, what's this all about? Why is the dad getting such little visitation? Dad's representing himself. He didn't have a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And mom's lawyer says, well, the caseworker, and this is why this is going to come in with our guest today in our topic. The caseworker said the dad's apartment is too small and there shouldn't be overnights. So I'm saying, so because he doesn't have money, he shouldn't be able to bond with his child? I was so incensed that a few things. A, that it was going to be rubber stamped. B, that the Department of Children and Family Services would align with that kind of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was like an uncontrollable tidal wave of, well, this is just how it goes. And you know what, Jill? Better than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we lose the non-custodial parents. That's how we lose them. They get disconnected.
That's right.
So that's
right.
How I am.
And that happens, as you know, all the time. And that's one of the things we're trying to expose or talk about on this show so that people understand that they're not walking into a courtroom to have all of the problems of their life rectified in front of a family court judge, because we know that doesn't happen. And if everybody, and I say this all the time, but if more judges were using the protocols that you use in your courtroom, and then they were attuned to parental alienation and visitation interference and all of the things that go with adversarial divorce, we could really solve a lot of the problems that are happening today, don't you think?
Yeah, well, you know, here the thing is, like the mom was saying, well, you know, he's late a lot. It's like we're creating a protocol based upon expectation of adversity, so we're playing as if the worst thing's going to happen and not even giving the guy a chance. You know, really outrageous.
It really is. It really is.
And then everybody just thinks, well, he's a late guy and he doesn't have a big apartment. So, I mean, I think his little boy would love to camp out in a sleeping bag and be with daddy. And you know what else? The caseworker said he was a good dad and all his desire for visitation was very legitimate. And even with that, but so our guest today plays right into this.
Yeah, let's talk about Catherine McWillie, and we have several people in common. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you, and I found you with Sarvi Emo, who is the founder of Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, brought you to my attention, which I'm so glad for. And then, of course, we have Jane Major in common, who's been on our show, and Michelle and I both know Jane.
Yeah, we love Jane.
What a wonderful woman. And then we also have in common that we've all been on the Gregory Mantel show, and he's a great guy that is highlighting and exposing parental alienation out in L.A., and I applaud him for what he does. But we have you here tonight, and I want you to tell us why you are involved in what you're doing now. You were an LAPD police officer, which is exciting. And how did you get to be a police officer? What led you down that path?
Well, actually, my family has been very involved with the military over many generations, and actually I understand the family goes back to Toronto on one side of the family, and we had police officers in Toronto. But I was just raised in an atmosphere where it was very important and built into the responsibility that we had to do more than just survive. We had more responsibility outside just our family, that we had a commitment to our community and to our country.
That's so patriotic. I love that. So how long were you in the police force?
Well, I was, let me just backtrack a little bit, if I could. You know,
sure.
I actually, when I was 21 years old and thought about becoming a police officer, I wasn't tall enough. There was a height requirement. So I actually came on the department when I was 28 years old, which really turned out to be an advantage. And then I was on the department for a little less than, about 24 years.
So you mean to say that you had a growth spurt after 21?
No, they dropped the height requirement.
I realize.
Over the years. So I was fortunate that, and there was a lot of people in front of me that, you know, fought for the rights of women to go back and do something more than just work in skirts and work, at a desk. But a lot of people fought to get out onto the streets to make even a bigger difference, and I benefited from that. And I'm very grateful for it. I loved my job as an officer, and I felt great pride on the last day, which was equal to my first day of service.
So you retired?
I did, and I only retired because I felt so strong about going into the area of family law. Actually, when I was a police officer, I began noticing that a significant part of my radio calls dealt with family law. In fact, on certain days and times, a family law takes up almost 100% of our radio calls for certain blocks of time, and a significant number of our police stations are now exchange locations for families seeking a safer environment to exchange and to have witnesses present. And actually, you know, we dealt with homicides and suicides and kidnappings and abductions related to family law. In fact, I've identified that family law may now be responsible for 25% of the crime in this country. And just to put one of those perspectives, numbers in perspective for your listeners, that's 4,000 homicides a year related to family law.
And what, when you said that so many of your calls were family law related, are you talking about domestic violence, or is it more than domestic violence?
It's everything. It's disturbances at schools. It's picking up kids early, not bringing them back. It's standing by while people move out of their apartments or retrieve property out of their homes. But I will say that some are severe. In fact, one of my last duties before my retirement was guarding somebody at a hospital who had set their spouse, first shot them, and then set them on fire. And in their excitement, the flashback from the flames lit them on fire as well. And so we're talking about a lot of devastation from the minor to the extreme. And there are even those of us in family law that are now of the opinion that we're seeing an escalation in child homicides related to family law, the ultimate act of revenge, taking the life of a child to keep the other parent from having them.
Well, I'd like to talk about one aspect that is really of a concern to Jill and I, and that is the setup for domestic violence when there isn't, which is so prevalent you can't even believe it. Because so many people will say to me, what I'm really afraid of is that I'm going to be set up, or my husband or my spouse is going to say that I hit them. And I know that your organization,
happened to me. So
it happens so much.
It absolutely happens. So.
And some lawyers look for that kind of avenue to get somebody thrown out of the house so you don't have to live together during the whole divorce, which could take years.
Right.
It is torture. But if people were listening and you were to say, how do you protect yourself against being set up?
Well, that's a really complicated response because there's a couple different scenarios. First of all, the courts have been put in a position where they have to be part lie detector, part, you know, seance person, part counselor. They have to know who's going to do, who's going to lie and by how much, who's going to need what court orders, and how much is a just an exaggeration of the process. Should a restraining order be issued? Should a restraining not be issued? And in fact, there's a protest going on right now in California where a judge did not issue a restraining order and one of the parents did murder the child and then commit suicide. And yet, as you said, there's also a prevalent problem in the courts where the courts are being utilized to seek restraining orders that are not valid, should not be issued in an attempt to gain an advantage. And the whole court system is being leveraged now in that direction with false allegations of child abuse to gain an advantage in custody. You know, and so your question is, how do you protect them yourself? And there are some different ways to do it. First of all, it may not be in someone's best interest to remain in a home. It puts everyone at risk, I think, during a time when everyone's emotional, and it takes 2 seconds to change the direction of your life, your spouse's life, and the direction of your family, in a change that can never be reversed. And so I don't know that staying in the home is necessarily in the best interest of either of the parties.
Well, it is if you're in a custody fight, because if you're the one who moves, you've just lost, like, a major source of leverage at the courts.
Oh, I know. And that's why I'm saying there's no simple answer. That's why the evaluation has to be, you know, sometimes you do have to go to court and you can make the argument without involving allegations of abuse. But as you said, those are very prevalent and they benefit one party usually more than the other. And but you're looking at if the emotions are that high, if they're willing to be that dangerous, again, separation.
No, I don't mean that. I mean a setup. I mean, obviously, real abuse is a whole different thing. And real abuse, you got to get out no matter what.
Correct.
That's
correct.
A given. I'm talking about what you see, because you see just as much of people trying to enhance their position through filing police reports as well. So
well,
how do you protect yourself against
that?
Do you get a nanny cam in every room? I mean, I've told people to do that.
Actually, filing police reports is getting more and more difficult. In fact, large police departments, including the Los Angeles Police Department, issued a policy a few years ago that said in custody orders and certain situations involving family law, they will not even take a police report. And smaller agencies for years have been giving just a carbon copy of a report that people fill out themselves, and the paperwork is worthless. All they do is take it to court, but there's no investigator, there's no determination of guilt, there's no district attorney, there's no filing of charges. It's referred just to family law court. And as you know, part of the reasons that we have the problems of false allegations of domestic abuse and false allegations of child abuse and all the other situations is that family law rarely makes a ruling on violation of court orders.
So, Catherine, what I want to go back to something that you just said, which I think is very important. In fact, there's a law that is coming up in the Judiciary Committee in Illinois, a new law based on a man that was murdered here in Illinois when going to pick up his daughter for visitation. It's called the Stephen Watkins Memorial Bill, or Senate Bill 1604. And what that bill is trying to do is give more teeth to visitation interference. But I would think, because there is a visitation interference bill here in Illinois in place already, this just gives it more charges, more there's more a court fine. But what I'd like to see is education of police personnel so that when they go to these domestic disputes or to a home when there's visitation interference, they know how to deal with the people and understand and how to recognize what's true and what's not. So how would you say that we can educate the police force when they're going to handle these things to indicate to them what's real and what's not?
Wow. Again, pretty loaded question, and I'm not even sure I answered your last one fully.
No, right, we'll get back. Okay. I agree.
I mean, these are, you know, we could almost do a full show on each of these questions. But as far as training officers, there in each state, there's a certification process that requires officers to go through specific training, just like there are requirements yearly for attorneys, for psychiatrists, psychologists, and judicial officers. Problem is that the country overall, their whole entire legal system is facing deficits. And so training has become even more difficult. And then add to that the fact that we change laws every year, add new laws. Everybody's on overload. You can barely keep track of the new laws, the laws that are being revoked, and the new training to diagnose or deal with mental health issues when you're dealing with family law, you know, sociopath. You know, some of these people are so convincing that even mm-hmm. the most experienced officer can make errors. And some of these children in their allegations are so convincing that, I mean, even lie detectors can't overcome all of these issues. And you're asking an officer to do it in a radio call that they have mostly, just like the judges, only moments to make a decision. So the process goes back to the courts, wherein the anarchy that we're currently experiencing, the breakdown we're experiencing, is because we're not holding people accountable for their actions. Because here's the thing. If judges said, and they give court orders, they say if the children are not picked up, if the children do not go with the other parent, we're going to start fining, we're going to start looking at changing of custody, we're going to start looking at jail terms, we wouldn't have some of the problems we have. And an example I can give of this is I had one parent call me from the South, because I get calls from all around the country. They called me and said, I don't know what to do. My child is refusing to come with me. The police have been called. The police are involved. Laid out this full entire scenario, asking me the same questions. What can we do? So we gave them some guidelines, but we said the deck is really stacked against you, and it will pretty much take a miracle. Well, I said, please call me again. Please tell me, you know, how we'll give you some more skills and give you some more pointers on how to deal with this. He called me and he said, I don't have a single problem. And it was because the judge told the other parent, if you cannot ensure that your child is going to go into the custody of the other parent for their custody and their visitation, then perhaps you don't have control of the child, and therefore the other parent should have them. They did not experience another problem. No jail time, no fines, just the statement, but with the expectation that there would be a follow-through by the judge and that custody would be exchanged. And here's the other problem. If a judge says, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we issued this court order, you're not following it, we're going to give you to the next time, everybody learns that the value of the statement by the judicial officer has no impact, and they're not going to follow the court order. And it would make everyone's job more effectively if police knew when we tell parents, you need to go back to court to deal with this issue, and they went back to court and the problem was solved, as opposed to them repeating the radio calls to say, we're having this problem, and the district attorney doesn't file charges either, except for in rare situations like abduction.
I can guarantee
no
you
penalty.
The police
no
officers
penalty.
Are sending the people to court. Because
yes.
I have people who are getting, you know, abused, and I said, "What did you go to the police?" Yes, but they said I had to come to court.
Right.
They wouldn't do anything. So they may be overlearning that lesson.
Well, and then you have the scenario where you have a lot of young officers, and they may not be comfortable in taking a strong stance to enforce a court order. And let's face it, some court orders are difficult to read because each attorney writes the terms and the language different. Each judge writes the language and the terms differently. And I have to tell you, as an officer, my partners and I would sometimes read court orders and say, I can understand why these people are having difficulties. I can't understand what it is they want.
Right. Just as in a parenthesis there, you know, to all the listeners, if you want the police to enforce your court order, don't get an order that says alternating weekends. They can't possibly know which weekend you're talking about.
Perfect example. Perfect example. They have to specify on what date the alternating weekends start. They need the courts to be more specific, like first, second, and third weekends, or first and fifth weekends. You know, that's the other thing that throws a monkey wrench. There are three times a year when there's a fifth weekend in the year, and that throws everything off as well, and people aren't even aware of that sometimes.
So,
but,
what
I mean, the other thing you have to add to this, though, guys, is that, you know, and Catherine, you may know this, and Michelle, sometimes I think, you know, you look at the utopia of what it should be, but sometimes people have orders written for them. They have no idea what they're getting, and they're handed an order. I mean, it happened to me. I had an order handed to me, and this is what it said. My lawyer had no input into it. The other lawyer wrote it. It's the good old boys thing again. And this guy was friends with the judge. He wrote an order, and that's what it was. So you get what you get. And then,
well,
you know, if you want to go back and spend more money to try to change it, you may or may not get a change.
Well, and you know, let me step back a little bit, too. Sometimes the police are used to take custody from a parent inappropriately. Like, for instance, Christmas Eve used to be a holiday. Columbus Day was a holiday that wasn't necessarily addressed in the court orders. But it is a recognized holiday by many agencies. So what parents would do is say, Christmas Eve is not a holiday, it's not addressed, and I just, you know, should have custody. And in certain scenarios, they would say, this person, going back to your previous statement, a scenario, would say, this person's dangerous, or I think they have guns, or they've threatened to hurt me. And so a whole, you know, significant number of police officers would show up, and people intimidated, afraid, would give up their children when they had a legal right to their children. But they're forced into believing that the police are there justified, and yet it's the other parent who's totally misrepresented the situation or bullied the police department. So
right.
I often tell parents, call a supervisor to the scene. If the supervisor does not give you the response, you may need to go to the watch commander. And some of these terms are different around the country. You have corporals versus sergeants.
Sure.
And detectives.
But what about the idea of, if you, just to go back to the setup thing, because I've thought a lot about this, and I wonder what you think about the person who thinks they're going to be set up. What would happen if they went to the police and they said, I think I'm going to be set up. I just want to go on record as telling you this. Can you give me any advice about what to do to make sure? I mean, what would somebody say to this person? Because that would be obviously something that you could actually do.
Well, here's the problem. The police, as law enforcement officers, we don't respond. We don't have a system in place to act on what has not happened. You know, we cannot respond to a radio call that's not occurred. We can't take a police report on what has not occurred. We take reports on what has occurred, what law has been broken. We're not in a position to take like a waiting list, so to speak, of people who could become victims. So the best advice, I like your idea, which is, one, put cameras in the house for protection, and I wouldn't necessarily advise the other party that you're going to do so. But on the other hand, in a lot of cases, I do. I say, I'm going to, you know, videotape our exchange. I'm going to tape record our conversation. And that, a lot of time, eliminates the problem. So if you say to the other person, I'm putting cameras throughout the house for your protection and mine so that we both can be judged, we both will be protected from inappropriate statements, inappropriate actions, because it's not unusual in cases, and I have knowledge of cases where someone is not even home and they're accused of abuse. The other person scratches themselves or injures themselves, and the other person wasn't home. Or as the police are responding, and I've taken calls like this, actually in one case from a police officer who was in uniform going through a divorce, had been married only a short time, and his the spouse was inside injuring themselves, and he stood outside, and he was, that particular person was in tears because they said, I don't know what to do. I'm going to lose my job. I'm standing outside. I'm 6'4", 300 pounds. No one will believe that I never touched this person.
And plus, and you're under the microscope with the inquiry boards. You know, the cops put it a lot harder.
Well, and that's why, you know, further into the discussion, I was bringing up the fact that as a result of all the phone calls and all the research and the unique position I'm in, we've decided, while we finish off some work on some software that we've developed as from my research, that we're going to start providing seminars. And we're only going to charge $49 for the seminars and provide people with resources that they don't necessarily have and information they don't necessarily get. And then also we're going to provide a coaching service, and so that we can answer people's questions without them burdening their attorney, adding to the cost of their case, and spinning their attorney into a lot of different areas and not being effective. You know, what we're trying to do is help people navigate the divorce process and make fewer errors, be less financially and emotionally impacted so they can take better care of themselves, better care of their children. And I've been doing coaching services for years and not charging people, but giving them the opportunity to make two or three phone calls because they're so desperate. But a lot of the time now that we've been spending on coaching is answering questions. No, this is not a case that would be appropriate for social services. No, this is not an appropriate case for restraining officers, restraining orders. And a lot of times people leap to that decision or leap to that option because they don't understand the system or their attorney is overwhelmed because they're constantly calling them. I mean, we even talk to our clients about, no, you don't need to call your attorney on this issue. You can handle it. Here's how you do that. You don't need to call your attorney on this issue or copy them on this email because you're not going to have them do anything. So our goal is to put more attorneys back in the courtroom to better represent their clients. And when they do communicate with their clients, that their clients are not emotional, not distraught, so they can understand what it is their attorneys are helping them with. But half the problems of restraining orders and domestic violence and the visitation issues, we have been able to help people with just by explaining things more in depth and with more background and more knowledge than what an attorney would necessarily have because their scope is limited. Mm-hmm. Where my background and my research of 10 years into family law and dealing with all different scenarios, court orders, and then background and testifying in court has given us a unique position. I say us because I always think of collectively all the input that I've had over the years. But, you know, there's not a need to go back to court every time to deal with every new issue. We even have worked and helped people use court orders to encourage good behavior and punish behavior without involving the courts for a better relationship for everyone.
How do you do that?
Catherine, I want to stop you for just a second. We're going to talk about custody calculations a little bit more, but I want to take a call that we have that's been on hold for just a moment from the 260 area code. Welcome, 260. Do you have a question for Catherine?
Yes, thank you. Actually, I wanted to say this is a wonderful resource, and I applaud you for doing it.
Thank you.
Is there a list of indicators or resources, such as your business? I mean, I'm hearing you say some of that, that a parent in a high-conflict divorce could use in order to contact their local authorities when they suspect that this could be happening or something terrible could happen. In other words, kidnapping or, God forbid, murdering the child. I mean, what measures can we take to prevent this from happening?
Well, you know, our company, my company is in the process of putting together various checklists that people can use. And you can actually Google checklists for domestic violence, checklists for abductions, checklists for kidnapping, and so on. And actually, throughout the United States, there are various websites that have been set up to address the issue. But and my company is actually specialized in the issue of abductions, domestic and international. I actually worked with one of the offices in Congress, along with some other persons lobbying in Congress, for the preparation of a report on the issue of should names be entered into a database that would allow airlines to check whether someone can legally fly out of the country or fly, you know, from one particular state to another. And Congress is really looking at some issues on how to deal with this more effectively. And part of what my company will do is help educate people. Like, for instance, most people on the issue of international abduction, they're unaware that the passport agency has an office that allows you to block your child's passport and will allow you to stop one from being issued. And then also you can ask the courts to surrender the passports of either the children or everyone involved during a period of time. And that's also things that our seminars will deal with. And Jill really got on me today earlier when we were talking about the fact that, you know, my people all over the country will be limited in how close they can get to our company, you know, when they can attend our seminars. She really stressed you need to get webinars to deal with these issues so that anybody, you know, in a camping tent, you know, in a small apartment or, you know, in a rural town can get information to protect themselves. But one of the great ideas that I heard recently was wasp spray. And instead of pepper spray for a security precaution. And I thought that was really a unique idea. And what they pointed out is pepper spray, first of all, is not always issued and is not always available in every state. And it's sometimes people are afraid to use it or they have to go to a class or they're licensed. So they don't want to go through the process because they don't feel time. They have the time available or the money. Well, wasp spray, nobody would think twice of seeing it on somebody's desk at work, in their car or in their home, in their bedroom or near their front door, and it has a far greater spray range, up to 20 feet, to get underneath the eaves of houses. And so we've actually advocated people using wasp spray as a last form of physical protection in the case that a situation deteriorates to that. But a lot of what we do is try not to put people in that position. And one scenario, just recently, we had a new client work with us, and they were going to go to a baseball game with their grandchild. And they said, we were told the other parent wouldn't be there. I said, I'll guarantee you the other parent will show up. Well, they were apprehensive because they were new to us. They were still getting adjusted. They weren't sure how, you know, they weren't sure about the information we were giving them. Well, they took our advice. They didn't go. The other parent showed up and likely would have become a difficult situation. It could have deteriorated into a physical altercation. So we even provide information that takes people out of scenarios that could put them at risk.
I think that is so incredibly important in situations like this because I can remember so many times and so many people that I talk to on a daily basis that are frightened to go to their child's school or they're frightened to go to a dance recital because they don't know what's going to happen. And I recall, you know, my daughter's eighth grade graduation, I was threatened. There were police cars outside the school, and I was threatened with arrest before I ever even stepped foot on the grounds. And it's a scary thing. If you're a law-abiding citizen, you're trying to do what's right, you're trying to use the common sense that we talked about earlier today, Catherine, that seems to go out the window in these situations, and you just don't know what's going to happen. You know that you're doing what's right, but all reason is thrown out the window, and anything can happen in these situations.
Well, another tactic that's being used in talking about restraining orders is we'll see a family law court order issued which gives certain visitation. Well, then one of the other party will go to court and seek a restraining order outside family law in civil court, again, outside the family law court system, and request a restraining order against the other party. So they are attempting to interfere and block custody utilizing a second court resource, and that we're seeing more often too, and that complicates things even further.
Well, what happens is we have emergency judges every day, and once a month we get to be an emergency judge, and there'll be a visitation order, and somebody will come in, and whoever's the emergency judge has no history on the case at all, and no file is provided. So they can come in and say, my children are in danger, and the judge doesn't have any way of knowing because there's no tracking.
Judge, Michelle, does the emergency judge always have history in family court, or are they just a judge that's called in, or is it a family court judge?
It's because a family court judge, which is bad, you know, which helps the situation.
Sure.
But I've had people come in for immediate turnover of custody without a file.
Well, and you know, in so many of the smaller counties or states, I can think of a Texas case right now that in Amarillo, Texas, that when that happens there, it's not even a family court judge. It's not even a lawyer that's become a judge that's practiced family law. It could be a criminal judge. In this case, it was a judge that worked on bankruptcies. So it could be a judge that has never worked into the family law field and doesn't know what's going on. And if you come in on an emergency and you've got a file that they've never even seen before, how can you get a reasonable order out of that?
Well, I think the courts have really tried in many ways to try to identify ways that they could respond. You know, I'm sure you probably realized that years ago, you would go into family law court, and every time you went before a different judge, and the court recognized that without that history, without that file, as you said, without that background, that they couldn't do an effective job in ruling in what was an appropriate manner. So what they said is, we're going to have families come back to the same courtroom or to the same judge, so that we can build the history and try to make better decisions. So, you know, I really applaud the courts because in many ways they have what I call, and I think I already addressed it, the unexpected, unfair expectation. So, you know, they're supposed to know who's going to be the better parent, not only to the other parent but to the children, and who's going to need what court orders and when. And they have 30 seconds to just a few moments to do that. And rarely do judges get the time they need to really thoroughly understand and review the evidence that's put before them, or to get some really convincing people on the stand. And let's face it, there's a lot at stake now in family law court, and people will say and do anything, and we don't hold them accountable to perjury. We don't even address perjury in family law court. And until we do, you know, that's going to be a problem. And we've actually researched a way that we think that we can present to the courts that will help them deal with perjury and rule on perjury.
How? Well, this happens every day.
Well, what you do is, certainly people make mistakes on the stand. That, you know, they're nervous, they're overwhelmed, they make mistakes. But the person who comes onto the stand and lies about the majority of everything every time they come on the stand, then you know that this is not a person making a mistake or under pressure makes an error. And how you identify the perjury is, now it would take the courts a little bit longer to make decisions, but you provide a transcript to both sides of the party. She receives a transcript of his statements. He receives a transcript of her statements. And then they go through and present to their attorneys. This is false, this is false, this is false. It would be a follow-up case. But you don't have the judges try to figure out which perjury.
I didn't understand that, though. I didn't get that. Could you say that a different
sure.
way?
Yes. What would happen is each of the opposing sides would receive a transcript of the statements made by their spouse.
Okay.
The spouses know what the lies are.
Okay.
And given the time to go through the statements line by line, which they don't have the ability to do in court, won't know in advance what they could do, don't know what the lies are going to be, can't be prepared for all scenarios. But after the fact and after the transcripts are issued, they go through and then they can present to the court, Your Honor, this is not an error. They testified on 13 points and 12 of them are false, and here's what they withheld from the court. The other side says they made two errors, and we can probably argue that they were mistakes.
Well, that's closing argument. You can order the transcripts of the trial and then say, this was false, this was false, this was false, he or she is not credible. I mean, that's not the step after that would be, when that happens, how do you get the perjury? How do you get the state's attorney to indict? That's the question.
Well,
finding what's lying is, the truth does tend to float up more often than you'd think.
Right, but here's the difference. Having no credibility is not a violation of the law. Perjury in court is a violation of the law. And so, not in a closing argument, but certainly it's appropriate to say in a closing argument, but then you also can, if we can get the courts to start ruling on perjury, and we can get the district attorney to rule and file on perjury, and we get the police departments to take reports on perjury. And we can do that as we start to identify effective measures and specific steps. Usually when you start talking about reform, the reform is too narrow in scope. It's not, as you said, there's a long line and process in the judicial system. Police officers, the detectives, the district attorney's office, civil courts, criminal courts, family law courts. Well, if you address a response that encompasses all of their functions in a way that makes sense and they can do it and will work in solving the problem, then that
picked up the phone and called the state's attorney and say, I've got an outrageous perjury case. I'll call you back.
Well, but
what would be beneficial to me and anybody listening would be how to influence them.
Well,
that's the piece I don't know. That's the only piece we need.
But that's not the state attorney. You don't need to start at the state attorney. It starts at the local.
At the police department?
Local police department. And if a court order by a judge says, I am giving you the option, but I am providing you the information that you have the right to go to your local police station and file a court order, file a police report for perjury. In fact, there's a case that I know attorney just worked on in which the judge said, you have no credibility with me, and in this particular case it involved law enforcement officers, and the judge ordered the district attorney to be notified and ordered the employment office, the employer of that police officer to be notified and requested the employer to provide witnesses. In fact, the employer already had witnesses in the courtroom to initiate an investigation. Now, obviously, that scope is because the police officers are subject to additional oversight, as you saw, that response can probably be addressed more effectively than someone who's not employed by the police department, not employed by the military, because the military has an oversight policy too. But those are the first steps, and if we took them more often.
Okay, so you're saying that people can go to the police and say, my spouse lied on the stand. They can do that, and the police will file a claim? But don't they have to get permission from the state, or they can just do it?
If they can show that on the advice of the judge hearing the case that the witness had no credibility in his opinion, perjured himself, and the parties can provide the evidence to the police, they can file a police report. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I'm not saying the police department will want to take it, and you might have to go to the watch commander. You may even have to go to the detectives to authorize it. And then you're going to have a difficulty with the district attorney's office, and you're going to have to push every step. But, I think that there's small baby steps slowly being taken to recognize that the perjury is not only affects the decisions that the courts can make on a case in error and wrongfully, And if we don't help the courts, if we don't help people, hold people accountable, then how can we expect some of these decisions to be correct if we're making them based on lies and false testimony?
Okay, so I didn't know about this, and I want to know what the statute of limitations is in Illinois. because I'm going to the police department tomorrow.
It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy, and it'll be a fight. But you can push, and you may be told no, and it may take a couple of court hearings where you can show, here's the transcript. You'd have to have the transcript. You'd have to have the hard evidence. And, you know, and depending on what the different – how many times they perjured themselves, what their employment is, what the results of the courts were, and so on. And, in fact, we tell people when they have, and I know a case, where someone consistently filed false police reports, false child abuse allegations against the other person. What they did is they went to court, and I only know of one case so far that's done it. It was in California. And the party was able to get a restraining order restraining them from filing false police reports. The argument in court was, Your Honor, I am not impeding their First Amendment right to free speech to make valid complaints. I'm interfering in their ability to harass and intimidate me, my constitutional right, and because no one has taken any action to bring any charges, regardless of the fact that there's penal codes for false police reports, for false child abuse allegations, I'm seeking the additional assistance of the court. If another allegation is made and it comes back false, that they would be subject to arrest.
Well, Catherine, I got to tell you, and I hate to keep using Sangamon County, Illinois, as an example, but my case specifically, but I know multiple cases where this has happened, where the other party has perjured themselves multiple times, and there is one particular lawyer who perjures himself consistently. Now, there have been I can probably think of 50 ARDC, Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission, complaints that have gone against this guy that have been unfounded, and probably many more that I don't even know about. So how do you combat a lawyer that lies, an alienating parent that lies, and the system that consistently, I mean, three judges in Sangamon County, Illinois, that consistently do the same thing over and over and over, and a police department that ignores what's going on. I love your remedy. I love it. I mean, I think it's outstanding. But how do you break through the wall that's been built by this cottage industry that exists in so many places in the United States? How do you pierce it? How do you walk through the brick wall?
I'm so glad she didn't ask me that.
I'm asking you next.
I'm so glad it's you, not me, Catherine.
I'm sorry, could we have a few easy questions here?
What is the meaning of life?
Yeah. I mean, you know, these are questions that took me 15 years, really, to ask, identify, answer, and I don't have all the answers. I can only tell you that, you know, anytime you start talking about reform, anytime you start talking about changes, it always starts with baby steps. It's never always successful with every case and in every scenario. And that's why the resources that you involve, and I'm sure that you would both probably agree, you have to have a good attorney who can represent you and identify what the party is doing in a way that presents strong evidence to the court. And an attorney by themselves can't do it. And more, we advocate the use of private detectives. We advocate the use of coaches for the attorneys in developing line of questioning. We believe in the coaching prior to testimony of witnesses. We believe in following, you know, in some cases, again, not all cases, if it's appropriate, you know, you may need to involve a private detective, but you have to have the resources. And unfortunately, resources take money. And, you know, a lot of the resources that we utilize, they come back to us and say, you know, Kathy, we really want to help these people, but we can't work for free. And, you know, we're here to support our families and to help these families, but we need to make a living. And so I've had to make it clear to people, you have a terrible scenario, we can work with you. And by the way, our coaching services, I don't charge people $250, $300, or $450. Right now, we're offering to coach people for $99 for an hour and a half, and our seminars are only $49. I try to make myself and my company and my services available to as many people as possible, and then we're going to go in and specialize in seminars and information. But again, going back to your question, it's baby steps, some failures, some successes. But that's what I'm hoping as we launch and we get better name recognition. And I haven't even gone into the development of our internet service that will be available. It'll work 24 hours a day. It'll be available 365 days a year, and it will be available for, you know, for use for $350 for an entire year for an individual. It will help the courts. It will help individuals. It should reduce court appearances by 70%. It identifies some of the issues that one caller came in with. How do I deal with possibility of abduction? You know, I've probably done 500 to 1,000 interviews over the 15 years. And, you know, started with a small segment that we thought we could impact, and it just kept growing. And now we'll be providing 7 services that are geared to help the courts, help the attorneys do a better job, and help individuals become better clients and help lower the bill so that they can retain legal counsel. You know, another part of the whole issue is finances. Usually the person who can retain representation the longest, look the best, lie the most effectively, and impact the children so they start, you know, giving information that's not true, are the ones who win. And the whole system is set up to reward them.
We have about 9 minutes left, and I want to make sure that our listeners understand custody calculations. I want to make sure they understand the services that you're offering. So in a nutshell, tell them exactly what they're getting, where you're going to be soon, and where we can see the services in person that you're offering. And I know we talked about it's you right now, so you're going to be everywhere, you know, you need to be to make this work for people who are going through adversarial divorce. So tell us, just in a nutshell, custody calculations, how they can reach you, where they can find you, all that good information.
Okay, first of all, custody calculations, we're right in the middle of just finishing off. We went live for a few hours yesterday, our new website with our new services. We're going to need probably another 72 hours, but our website URL address is custodycalculations.com. The corporate number for the company is area code 702-375-9389. And then we have a special number set up for our divorce coaching services, custody calculations, divorce coach. And that's area code 702-675-5120. And I'm assuming, Jill, you'll put all this up on your website as well.
Yes,
after
this. Absolutely.
Okay. And then the company will be providing 3 services, an internet service that will provide 7 specific services to help people with their divorce. And I don't want to go into that too much because we're just in final development and we don't want too much information to sort of get out there before we're up and running. And then the divorce coach and then our divorce boot camp. And so what we see is a full method of which to address every aspect going through a divorce to help people get through the entire process. And sometimes those lucky few that just have a few problems, we can even expedite their issues and help them and help them, you know, do some options they may not are even aware of. Like real quick, one parent, and I try never to identify a gender because I don't care if you're a male or female. If you violate the court orders, you are violating the law. You're putting your children at risk. You're putting yourself at risk and the other person. And we have a disobedience to our court system that is not acceptable for our society, and we're falling apart as a result. But this person going through a divorce felt like they were being held hostage because they were 3 years in the divorce process. They were still not divorced. And I said, bifurcate. And they said, what's that? who explained how you can separate property and custody from the divorce process. Now, some states make it more difficult than others, but they said, wow, didn't know I had the ability to do that, and they were able to be divorced, and they no longer felt they were being held hostage.
So, Catherine, when you're going and you're doing live seminars, and I know you're going to Toronto, I'm trying to entice you to come to Chicago, but are you
I'm sure I'll get there.
I hope so. When you're doing these seminars, are you doing it state and when you're in Toronto, will it be geared to Canadian law, will it be geared to Illinois law when you do Chicago, California law when you're there? How is that working for you?
Well, you know, the amazing thing is that for the most part, the information that we provide is not specific to filling out forms. That's the job of your attorney. And it's not specific to enforcement of a particular law. That's the job of your attorney. What we're doing is providing information like good resources, good attorneys, good counselors, good custody evaluators who have come to us highly recommended. Like if someone calls us, they can't just get put in. We provide grab bags in our seminars too as an incentive to the first 20 people who register early. And these are people with polygraph, private detectives, that they won't get anywhere else. And we're collecting this information and putting together a database for all the cities. But mostly what we deal with is the behavior issues. Like, for instance, not going to court on every issue. That's pretty general on what the issues are. I mean, if you take the names may change in each of the cases, but it's the behavior that's pretty consistent. I mean, wouldn't both of you agree that the behaviors are issues, the domestic violence is a problem, but that has nothing to do with Illinois specifically or Canada specifically.
Right.
It's an overall problem in process. And dealing with people when they withhold custody, or the constant barrage to change the custody at the last moment, or the pressure people feel to change their court orders. In fact, I'm of the mindset now that you should rarely ever go to court to change a court order, except for under the rarest of circumstances. People don't even know that they can negotiate their contracts, their court orders, between themselves. If they're getting along well, sure, give the other party more custody, more contact. If they stop behaving well, you didn't lose anything in court. You simply
say,
I'm
sorry. Yes, you did.
Yes, you did.
You've got to put it in writing. You have to have a court order because if you don't do that, and you don't need the lawyers necessarily, but if you don't do that, the minute it goes sour, you're going to have a nightmare.
No, I think you've misunderstood me. I'm not saying don't ever go to court. You need an original set of court orders specifying.
No, you always need to get a court order when you modify.
Well, here's what
if you don't do that, as soon as there's trouble, they're going to say, he never came, he never went along with the visitation, he did whatever
right.
he wanted to do, she didn't
Except
show up,
for,
she wouldn't let me, I came, she said no, and that's what I live with every day. So,
except for what we're not saying doing this all verbal. We do agree, I completely agree with you, that if it's their word against your word, whose word do you accept in court? So what you do is you put the agreement in writing between the two parties and with the specific language that's revocable at any time. It's not replacing the court order. It's only an agreement for a limited time between the parties, but does not replace or supplant the court order as long as the parties agree to this temporary situation. And what you do is you give them apples or little carrots dangling in front of them. Listen, I'd be happy to work with you if you weren't always taking me to court, if you weren't always late with the children, if you brought the children home on time, if we weren't having all these difficulties. Or I'd be happy to work with you if you gave me some notice, 30 days, but 5 minutes or 20 minutes before you're supposed to be here or 2 or 3 days and you're constantly doing, I'm not going to adjust the court order. I'm going to live with the court order. I'm not adjusting on the court order. Things get better, adjust a little bit, give a little bit of a reward. They stop, you know, being good. They start bringing the children home later. You say, I'm sorry, if you want any change, I'm not going to agree to it. We're having too many problems. But you haven't given up anything like you would if you went to court and gave them more custody or changed the visitation in a court order. Because you know, once you give up custody, once you give up visitation, or once you gain additional time, you can never correct that situation. You can never take that back.
Well, I guess it's just you don't want to lump it all into one situation. If you're talking about changing a weekend, but if you're talking about a core change, such as the children are going to live with you for a while, such as you're going to get 4 days instead of 3 days, or entitlements like that, if it's a small carrot, as you say, then that's just behavior modification through common sense. And
right, but you know common sense doesn't exist when you go through a divorce.
Then you're saying that it does to get these out of court orders. So
okay,
I'm just saying it's not quite worked that way.
We have to do another show all about this. And Catherine, I'd love to invite you back if you'd be willing to come. We have about.
It would be my pleasure.
I want you to give that website again.
It's www.custodycalculations. Just give us another 72 hours, but you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, and YouTube. We just put our Twitter page together. We just put our Facebook page together, but we do have some videos up on YouTube and MySpace. So we're getting the word out.
Well, this has been a great show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for your time, and we wish you the very best.
Oh, no, and you guys are doing a great job, too. I hear wonderful things about you.
That's great. Thank you. And we will vintage clothes sometimes. We have that in common, so we will talk about that and share closets sometime soon. I have had a terrific show with both of you, and thank you all for listening in. We'll talk to you soon. Don't forget, we will be talking to David Goldman soon and Bill Hudson, Kate Hudson's dad, about the alienation process. So tune in. Stay tuned. We love you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.